So again, the tide began to turn. And after Mary's death, Protestantism had a new champion in the person of Elizabeth, her successor. But at the young age of 25, Elizabeth faced many problems, including not just the warring religious factions, but also a claim to the throne from Mary Stuart on the one hand, and an impending threat from the King of Spain, Philip II, who now claimed to be the rightful heir of the English throne as the husband of the late Queen Mary. As a result of all this pressure, Elizabeth favoured a moderate settlement that would avoid any religious extremes, known as the Elizabethan settlement. And so in 1559, Parliament passed the second Act of Supremacy, declaring the English Church independent from Rome, by conferring on the English monarch the title the Supreme Governor of the Church of England, making her sovereign over spiritual and ecclesiastical, as well as temporal matters. The title was a little less offensive than the one used by Henry, the supreme head of the church, and avoided taking a title reserved for Jesus, the true head of the church. This Elizabethan settlement also enforced the use of the prayer book in 1552 as the common liturgy. It made absence from church punishable by a shilling fine, and the 39 articles, I don't know what that works out at today, that would bring in a bit, wouldn't it? We'd be able to pay our parish share several times over. And it's, I don't know, we'd better look it up. And the 39 articles were accepted by Parliament as the creed of the Anglican Church. Now, although it was moderate enough, it nevertheless aroused the undying fury of Pope Pius V, who promptly excommunicated her, as they did. Elizabeth retaliated by bringing in an Act of Parliament aimed at the Jesuits who were planning to recapture England for the papacy. The political and religious heat was rising. Now, like an ingenious move in a game of chess, the Pope then turned to the King of Spain for support. You know, the widower of Mary I. And as a loyal Catholic, he was only too glad to help. And he knew that Elizabeth was also secretly aiding his rebellious Dutch subjects. So in 1588, remember that date from your history O-levels? He began to gather a fleet of ships known as the Spanish Armada. After two or three skirmishes along the English Channel, the Queen went in person to Tilbury to encourage her forces, and on the 18th of August, she gave what is probably her most famous speech, which I thought I'd read some of. "My loving people, we have been persuaded by some that are careful of our safety to take heed how we commit ourselves to armed multitudes for fear of treachery. But I do assure you, I do not desire to live to distrust my faithful and loving people. Let tyrants fear. I have always so behaved myself that under God I have placed my chiefest strength and safeguard in the loyal hearts and goodwill of my subjects. And therefore I am come amongst you, as you see at this time, not for my recreation and disport, but being resolved in the midst and heat of battle to live or die amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdoms and for my people, my honour and my blood, even in the dust." You see, the Spanish Armada was not just a political invasion, it was a religious invasion. "I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but..." That doesn't go down well today. But I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too, and think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm. To which, rather than any dishonour should grow by me, I myself will take up arms. I myself will be your general, judge, and rewarder of every one of your virtues in the field." It could have been Churchill. Magnificent stuff. In September, the Spanish fleet sailed north round Scotland and in 1588 was hit by an unusually strong North Atlantic storm, perhaps associated with a high accumulation of polar ice off the coast of Greenland. As a result, many more ships and sailors were lost to cold and stormy weather than in combat. When Philip II learned of the outcome, he is said to have declared, "I sent the Armada against men, not God's winds and waves." You see, this is where history teaches us not to walk down the corridor of arrogant self-reliance. We can make it on our own. And whichever side we stand on, God can turn the course of events unexpectedly, turning success into failure or failure into success. This victory established England as the champion of Protestantism in Europe, also helping the Dutch and the French Calvinistic churches against their Catholic rulers, and ruined the Pope's chances of regaining England for the Roman Catholic Church for at least the next 450 years. And thus, conditions returned to a Protestant orientation. Despite Elizabeth's victory against the papacy, she couldn't sit on her laurels because of the rising power of some in the church who wanted to change the episcopal form of church government, remember that's bishops, into a Presbyterian or congregational church governed by elders and the laity, respectively. The question of how the church should be governed now became the dominant question. Not all of them necessarily wanted to be independent churches or separate the church from the state. But most of them believed that the people under God were the source of sovereignty in the church, not the king or a pope or a bishop. And so it's from about this moment in church history that the church really begins to fragment into diverse groupings and denominations, sometimes trying to reform from within, but sometimes breaking off from the national church. Some would eventually migrate to New England on the Mayflower after finding temporary safety in Holland. These pilgrim fathers would eventually become the founders of the United States of America. Others became the major influences in the English Baptist movement, all in the attempt to answer that vexed question, who should govern the church? Now the Puritans were not puritanical in the sense of being uber strict killjoys in the way it's come to mean today. It means they really wanted just to purify the church because they thought the English Reformation hadn't gone quite far enough. They were by no means an extreme faction. In fact, they won the support of many merchants, lawyers, and country gentry. They simply objected to the continued medieval use of rituals and vestments, saints' days, clerical absolution, kneeling for communion, and so on. Their writings were pastorally driven and warm-hearted. They promoted a theology intended to soften the heart and enlighten the conscience. And one of my favourites, for example, is Jeremiah Burroughs, the rare jewel of Christian contentment. And it's a beautifully clear book, rich in language and excites the heart and mind. And then we come to Thomas Cartwright, and the emergence of Cartwright as professor of theology at Cambridge in 1570 shifted the emphasis in the Puritan efforts. He and others like him wanted greater reform of theology and church government. He and his followers wanted to make the 39 Articles even more Calvinistic, if that was possible. More significantly, he opposed government by bishops. And it's into this context that we then find a man called Richard Hooker, one of the greatest theologians of the Church of England. Hooker's best known work is entitled The Laws of Ecclesiastical Polity, with the first four books being published in 1594. It's a massive and important work. It's massively important as well. Its principal subject being the proper governance of the churches, church polity. That's what that means. What was at stake was the position of the queen, or the king, as the supreme governor of the church. You see, if Martin Luther's priesthood of all believers, which is where it all came from, set out in the Babylonian captivity of the church, is taken to mean that all God's people have a say in church government, then having a monarch as your supreme governor is intolerable. On the other hand, if the monarch is appointed by God to be the governor of the church, as well as the state, then local parishes going their own way on doctrine was similarly intolerable. Now, in order to understand the Church of England today, we need to know what this man Hooker represented. Hooker is later cited as being the creator of Anglicanism, if you like, as Anglicanism as a middle way between Rome on the one hand and the Reformation on the other. It has become known as the Via Media, the middle road. That's by those who, like Keble in the Oxford movement, wanted to shift the Church of England back towards Rome. But for a start, he never used the word Anglican or the phrase middle way, via media. In fact, he was opposed. He wasn't going towards Rome at all. He was opposed to papal authority, of course, and in another document he even described the papacy as the Antichrist, the beast of the apocalypse. And you'll hear people talking about the Pope in those terms from time to time today. Now, but even today, you see, in the Church of England, some insist that scripture, reason, and tradition have equal authority, like three legs of a stool. And that this somehow defines, is the defining mark of Anglicanism. But for Hooker, no, the real problem was this. Some of the let me go back a bit. They think that the three legs of the stool defines Anglicanism. But Hooker didn't consider reason and tradition on a par with scripture. They weren't all equal for him as a source of authority. He simply granted that where the Bible was silent on a certain matter, men were free to use their discretion and judgment and use tradition and reason to good effect, as best as possible, very much like Luther, who allowed music in church and a whole load of other things, but unlike Zwingli, who would kind of sweep it all away. So for Hooker, the real problem was this. Some of the radical Puritans at the time wanted to throw out everything associated with the medieval church, and that to be truly reformed, one needed to be as unlike the Roman church as possible. And it's this that Hooker was really against, not the Reformation principles. So we need to understand Hooker in its right context. He was truly reformed, and he believed that scripture alone was infallible and inerrant. Once we understand this, we can agree that Hooker was indeed the greatest Anglican theologian. I mean, we agree to that anyway, but he was. And that, because of Hooker, Anglicanism has become a coherent reformed theology. It's not just sort of standing loosely some fudge between Rome and the reformers. It was rock-solid Reformation stuff in line with Calvin, more or less. His ecclesiastical polity is remembered not only for its stature as a monumental work of Anglican thought, but also for its influence in the development of theology, political theory, and English prose, being one of the first major works of theology written in English. I don't think it's the sort of thing you'll look at for your bedtime reading, unless you really are an insomniac, but that's the laws of ecclesiastical polity for you, anyway. Now, of course, when Elizabeth's successor, James VI, King of Scotland, became James I, King of England, in 1603, the Puritans hoped that this Calvinistic king would set up a Presbyterian government in the Anglican Church. They presented him with a petition signed by nearly 1,000 Puritan ministers. By the way, they were still ministers in the Church of England, of course, these Puritans, but upon his arrival, and asked that the Anglican Church be completely, quote, purified in liturgy and polity. So that's where they were going. But when they demanded a second time at the Hampton Court Conference in 1604, he got a bit irritated and denounced Presbyterianism. It wasn't all bad. The net result of this meeting was a permission to make a new English translation of the Bible, the Authorised Bible, also known as the King James Version. It was completed in 1611, replacing the Geneva Bible and shaping English language and culture forever, and described as the very greatest literary achievement in the English language, whose influence cannot be measured even today. Influence on all of English culture. The King James Bible. That's James I. His son, Charles I, who was an honourable, brave, but weak-minded man who believed even more strongly in the union between king and episcopacy than his father before him. Many Puritans, worn out by his pro-Catholic policy and hoping for better conditions, migrated to America. At least 20,000 Puritans left for America between 1628 and 1640. To make matters worse, when Charles appointed William Laud as Archbishop, it created havoc in Scotland. In 1637, William Laud foolishly attempted to force a new book You can feel it already. If you forced this new Book of Common Prayer on the Church of Scotland to bring uniformity to the two nations, the Scots were having none of it, and of course they rebelled. It's the period when Jenny Geddes was supposed to have thrown the stool she was sitting on in St Giles' Church in Edinburgh at the minister's head for daring to say Mass at my ear. I keep wanting to say that in a Cornish accent, but I kind of resist. It's probably Scottish. So in 1638, the Scottish people signed a national covenant to defend their beloved Presbyterianism. You know, that's the rule of elders, you know, lay people who, sort of like a PCC in a way, but a ruling body. And proceeded to invade England. So in order to raise money to defend England against the Scots, you see, this is big political stuff, isn't it? Charles called a parliament in 1640 known as the Long Parliament. Is that new to you? Does that ring bells? The Long Parliament. And it was long because it lasted 20 years. But when this parliament was unable to agree on the subject of church government, it split the nation, England, and gave rise to the English Civil War. Yeah, the English Civil War. Those who wanted to retain the episcopacy were known as royalists or cavaliers. Those who wanted Presbyterianism, on the other hand, were Puritans, known as the Roundheads. And the ultimate success of the Puritans they won was down to a man called Oliver Cromwell. And it was his unexpected military skill in organising a well-trained and highly disciplined army, a cavalry of godly Puritans known as the Ironsides, that won the day. They captured the king, and they took control of England. The Puritans were in charge. Meanwhile, 3 years earlier, in 1643, Long Parliament finally managed to make a decision about church government and abolished episcopacy and commissioned the famous and hugely important Westminster Assembly in London. During this time, they formulated three documents: the Directory of Worship, the Form of Government, and most important and famously of all, the Westminster Confession of Faith in 1646. This Calvinistic standard of faith was duly adopted by the Scots in 1647 and by the English in 1648. The work of Westminster was complete, and the Westminster Confession continues to set the standard of faith for nearly all the larger American Presbyterian churches today, and many in this country as well. A massively important document. But such is the way the tides of church history flow and ebb. The Presbyterian Puritans should have paid a little more attention to the army which had supported them. Tired of their refusal to pay their wages, long overdue, and their unwillingness to have anything but a Presbyterian state church, Cromwell, who preferred separation anyway, ordered Colonel Pride to purge Parliament in 1648. The Presbyterians were driven out, leaving a rump of Congregationalists in charge. After Charles's execution, Cromwell created a Commonwealth and dismissed Parliament, set up a protectorate, and ruled as dictator, backed by his own army. After Cromwell's death in 1660, the English recalled Charles II to become their ruler and once again adopted episcopacy. Backwards and forwards, like a game of tennis. A new code of laws called the Clarendon Code made it illegal for Puritans to meet and put positions in the state and church in the hands of Anglicans. This new code included an act of uniformity which prescribed that any minister who refused to conform to the Book of Common Prayer by St. Bartholomew's Day in 1662 should be ejected from the Church of England. This became known as Black Bartholomew's Day, as a reference to the St. Bartholomew's Day massacre of 1572. One Puritan minister from the Northwest, Oliver Heywood, estimated the number of ministers ejected at 2,500. Including many like Richard Baxter, who were simply in favour of moderate reform of episcopacy, and which the bishop differed in grade, a form of episcopacy in which the bishop differed in grade but not in rank from the presbyter or the priest. The Great Ejection left a substantial section of English society excluded from public affairs and university degrees for a century and a half. Its most distinguished writers were John Milton, whose epic poem Paradise Lost is a theological work in poetic form, and John Bunyan, famous for Pilgrim's Progress, that brilliant allegory of the Christian life. Despite the remarkably broad agreement on in most other areas, the debate over church government has caused this country untold harm. The Clarendon Code effectively ended any possibility of the Anglican Church and nonconformists coming together under a single religious and social banner. Yeah, that's been true, I think, to a large degree. All the independent churches and Anglican... No. It polarised religious groups for many years, and religious intolerance would be an ever-present feature of British life for at least the next century. Not until James II was driven from England in the Glorious Revolution of 1688 was toleration granted to nonconformists. The Bishop of Liverpool, J.C. Ryle, referred to the ejection as an injury to the cause of true religion in England, which will probably never be repaired. Well, it's probably fair to say that the Reformation in England only really came to an end in 1701, with the Act of Settlement, or the Act of Succession. This Act of Parliament was designed to secure the Protestant succession to the throne and to strengthen the guarantees for ensuring a parliamentary system of government. The Act also laid down the conditions under which alone the crown could be held. No Roman Catholic nor anyone married to a Roman Catholic could hold the English crown, as we know about so well. The sovereign now had to swear to maintain the Church of England, and of course after the Act of Union in 1707, the Church of Scotland also. And so here endeth the English Reformation.